Hey everybody, welcome back to Bucketheads Land Grant Holy Lands College Basketball Podcast. Welcome to episode 38. Welcome to the slowest 2 weeks of basketball news that we have had since last summer, Justin.
Yeah, this is May. As John Rothstein likes to say, we sleep in May, and we've been sleeping.
Yeah, it's been pretty slow. We're sitting around thinking about what we can how we can fill time this week with college basketball in May is absolutely dead because TBC hasn't started yet. A lot of teams are done putting rosters together. You know, like I said, TBT hasn't started yet. Preseason practice and stuff hasn't started yet. The freshmen aren't even on campus yet. So there's really not much going on. The Buckeyes did make one addition, though, since our last episode. Their final roster spot that we were both adamant would go to a big man went to a 6'5" point guard named Isaac Likely from Oklahoma State. It's a very versatile player, very intriguing player, but another guard.
Yeah, I only thought it'd go to a big man just because I thought that's what I thought they would kind of zoom in on just because of needs. But they clearly had a plan with what they were trying to do with this team. First of all, I didn't know Isaac Likely was on the radar. So that was kind of two out of the three transfers came out of nowhere. Tanner Holden just came fast, and then Isaac Likely, there was no buzz around his name. I forgot he even entered the portal, and all of a sudden he committed. So that was really cool. I love him. I love his game. I always have. I know this is the easy thing to say about him, but he is kind of just a Swiss Army knife. You could put him anywhere, 1 through 4. You know, it will be interesting to see kind of where he starts the season. I do think he's a starter on this team. I think he'll probably start at the 2. But it just depends on what they kind of want to do with Sean McNeil. I think they're going to bring him off the bench, but you know, if you want to start Sean McNeil, you can start Likely. It'd be pretty incredible if their starting lineup was Likely, Sean McNeil, Tanner Holden, Justice Suing, and Zed Key, because you'd have three guys that are transfers in, a guy who didn't play last season, then Zed Key, who was injured a lot of last season. So Ohio State is looking at, not even from a, like, obviously I'm a fan, so I'm going to watch every game, but even if I wasn't an Ohio State fan, I would be extremely curious to tune into some Ohio State games early and see what this team is, because they're going to rely so heavily on transfers, so heavily on freshmen, and good freshmen, but freshmen. And their opening season schedule, I mean, they're going to play in their first 7 games, they're going to play 5 ranked teams, Likely. So, that's a pun. But still, 4 or 5 ranked teams. So it'll be very interesting to see how this November goes for them. I think it'll be good for them. I don't know if it'll be good on this court, but it'll be good for them. But we'll see.
I only watched Oklahoma State last year when like somebody good was playing Oklahoma State, because they had the postseason ban this year. So I never really cared about Oklahoma State, so I didn't watch a ton of them. I only watched them if, like, you know, number 2 Baylor was playing Oklahoma State. So I can't say that I watched a ton of him. But I do think he probably starts. We know that Chris Holtmann is very, very much, I'm trying to think the words here. He loves his older players. I guess that's the simple way to put it. So I would be kind of surprised if he brings in a 5th-year point guard who is a starting caliber player and then has him come off the bench behind Bruce Thornton, a freshman who's going to be very good. But asking a freshman point guard to have the keys to the car from day one and expect success, like the high standards that Ohio State has for this program, I would be surprised if like Likely came off the bench. So I think he's probably your starting point guard, which means that I think that they would probably go, just like you said, with McNeil and then Holden, Suing, Key. I don't love, it's a little undersized, but there's a lot of plug and play pieces where you can kind of switch guys around.
Yeah, I did say the opposite. I actually think Thornton will start day one and McNeil will come off the bench. But it just depends. It just depends on kind of where he thinks Likely fits the best. I think he fits best at the 2 on this team. But if he fits best at the 1, then yes, I do think he would start over Thornton. I just think Right now, he fits best at the two, and I think he'd start over. I don't see McNeil playing 30 minutes a game on this team. I think he's going to play more like 20, which, again, it's not low minutes. It's half the game. But I don't know that – it'll be interesting to see also how the minutes go because you this team is 12 deep, legitimately. You know, you want all the freshmen. Obviously, Bowen Hardman is going to assume – we'll assume he redshirts. All the other four freshmen, you want to get on the court this year. They're all good enough to get on the court this year. You've got your four guys returning or five guys returning that all should play. I mean, there's nobody returning that I don't see that shouldn't belong in the rotation. Kalen Etzler is kind of a wild card because we haven't seen him, but I think his talent, his skill set can be very useful. Eugene Brown struggled, but I still think he's useful for this team. I mean, he started last year a little bit out of necessity, but still, he knows how to play this game. Zed Key is going to be starting. Seth Townsend, Justice Ewing, obviously you want on the court if they can. And then you have your three transfers. That's 12 guys. So it's going to be really interesting to see how they start to shore up the lineup. I don't see them playing 12 guys all season. That's just not how that works. And obviously injuries will happen and, you know, things will happen. It'll kind of work itself out. But right now this team's pretty much 12 deep. So we'll see.
I think with transfers, and I could be off base here, but when you see transfers pick specific locations to go play their like final year, final 2 years, I always assume that's because they've probably been given some kind of assurance from the head coach that X number of minutes are going to be there for you. So, for example, Sean McNeil, like I have a hard time believing that a guy who started at West Virginia and could have gone to any number of schools would choose to go to a school where they're going to tell him straight up, you're going to be coming off the bench for your final season. I could be wrong, and honestly, I probably would prefer it if he came off the bench, but I would be surprised if he came off the bench. Same with Likely, same with Holden, except I think that Tanner Holden's going to be really, really, really good, and I wouldn't want him coming off the bench anyways. But
I think their three through five is set. I think it's going to be Holden, Suing, Key. I don't see that changing at all. And I will say this, I'm in the minority on this. Most people I've seen, they're projecting rosters, do think it'll be Likely and McNeil starting. I just feel a certain way that I think
That's not the fun lineup.
Yeah, you know, yeah. I'm just very interested to see what Bruce Thornton can do day one. And also, I mean, look, he's going to be kind of the elephant in the room the entire time. But Seth Towns, if he's fully healthy, he's a starting caliber player. I don't know what they're going to do minutes wise with him, but like. Again, the last time he played healthy, he was the Ivy League Player of the Year. So that's me thinking optimistically, obviously. I know most people, including yourself, don't expect much more than 4 or 5 points per game. I don't know that I really do either. But, you know, is there a world where they start Likely, Holden, Suing, Towns, and Key? Maybe. I don't know.
Right.
It's interesting.
The surprising outcome for Seth Towns is like if
Big Ten Player of the Year.
I will literally eat a tomato whole. I will literally just eat the tomato like an apple if Seth Towns wins Big Ten Player of the Year.
I know somebody who does that. So
seek help immediately. like I said, the shock would be like say come January, say Seth Towns is averaging like 25 minutes a game and he's averaging like 11 points per game. I feel like the shock wouldn't be that Seth Towns is good enough to score 11 points a game. The shock would be that Seth Towns is healthy enough to play enough that he's scoring 11 points a game.
Oh, 100%.
That would be the shock. If he's healthy enough to give you 20 to 25 minutes, I don't think anybody, even the pessimistic Ohio State fans, even those people don't doubt that he can do it. They just doubt that he'll even be able to be on the floor to do it, which he thinks he will be.
Yeah, and that's the thing. He knows his body, and granted, he's probably looking at it extremely optimistically, but he does know his body better than anybody, and if he says he can do it, he's – and also, I remember last year when he was talking, he never talked this positively about his injuries. He was like, you know, we're making progress, whatnot. Now he's like, I'm good to go. I'm rolling, you know. You know, like I said, he said to – I think it was Jared Smalley where he was like, I've never – like, I feel like I have so much more to give in Ohio State. Like, people have not seen – what I can do. I'm ready to show them. So like, that's very confident talking. So I mean, even when he was injured in the COVID year, you know, he was only playing 10 minutes a game. He was giving you 5 points per game. It's, you know, that's a bucket every 2 minutes. Like, he was still scoring at a decent clip for what he was playing, you know? So I think this whole season could come, the whole season is probably going to come down to the freshmen, what they give you. But I think it could also come down to what Seth Towns can turn into, which, like I said, if he's healthy, he's a hell of a player. There's nobody will deny that.
Yeah. There's,
just a pretty big if.
There's so many unknowns, I think, with this roster still. Like, they don't have to fill spots, but there's unknowns. Like, let's say, you know, Seth Towns doesn't play, Sean McNeil is not great. You end up having, essentially, if those two guys aren't playing well or not playing, you essentially have 0 3-point shooters on your team. If Seth Towns can't play and Sean McNeil doesn't play well, what if they have no shooters? That's a huge problem. What if the rebounding is way worse this year than it was last year when it was already really bad? That could be a problem. Then you could flip it and say, well, you have guys on this team who maybe have not been 3-point shooters previously, but they haven't shot it at a high volume. Or you have freshmen who were good 3-point shooters in high school, and we're going to assume that that's going to translate. And then what if we assume that Ohio State doesn't have a 10-rebound guy, but they have 6 guys who grab between 4 and 8? Like, it could be either way. And, like, I've seen people say the second set of situation, and I've also seen people say the first set.
Well, and that's the interesting part because – and I completely agree with what you just said. There's two sides of this coin. With the rebounding thing, like, Zed Key is going to be a better rebounder just because of health. I mean, he was clearly hurt most – like, not most, but a lot of towards the end of last season. I think people kind of forget what Zed Key gave Ohio State November, December, and January, mainly because of how good Branham got, and also Key got hurt and kind of – I agree. Key has things to work on. I don't love a guy who can only shoot the ball from 2 feet. You know, he struggled rebounding at times. I understand all that. But then at the same time, like, they played Duke. He outplayed Mark Williams, who played in the Final Four. So there were very good moments for a guy who's a sophomore. I'm very interested.
He's got to do it consistently, though. Yeah, I feel like that's the comeback for people is like, cool, he played well in one game. So what else did he do? And I feel like you have to bring up the Duke game, but also it's like, you look at his shooting percentage, and I don't have his stats up right now, but I'm pretty sure he shot just over 50% from the floor, which is very good to shoot between 50 and 60%. Like, when Zed Key gets the ball in the paint and he's able to back a man down, it usually doesn't matter if they're 7 foot or 7'1". Like, he usually gets what he wants when he has the ball down low. His problem has been foul trouble and playing enough minutes that you can actually have him on the floor to utilize how efficient he is, because he gets in foul trouble and he only ends up playing 21 minutes a game.
Yeah, I do think the foul trouble thing is a little bit of recency bias, because it happened a lot towards the end of the season. I don't remember him having that issue in November and December and stuff. And again, you're not playing as, you know, conference plays when it matters.
He played 19.8 minutes per game and he was their starting center.
Yeah, but most centers aren't giving you 30 minutes a game. I mean, they're just big guys.
I think that he needs to be able to give you at least 20 to 25 minutes per game this season.
I think this season he's going to look in the 22-25 range and have Okpara play 15 to 20, and that'll be your two centers. And I'm cool. I'm comfortable with that. And this is kind of boding that I'm assuming when Okpara gets on campus, he's going to gain weight. It's just how it works. Like, guys just do – that's just half. That's how it works for everybody. So I'm fine with Okpara playing day one. And then, you know, to the rebounding thing, you're essentially adding especially with the transfers and with Suing, you're essentially adding 15 to 20 rebounds a game, because Holden gave you 7 last year. Suing can give you 6 to 7. That's 14, 15. And then you have Likely who's averaged 5 pretty much his entire career. So, you know, you're bringing in these guys who they're not obviously 7-footers. Ohio State fans love the 7-footer, but you don't have to be a 7-footer to be a good rebounder. Rebounding is a skill. And likely you can very comfortably call him a good rebounder. It's not like you don't luck upon 5 or 6 rebounds for your career for 4 years.
For a guard, he's a good rebounder.
Yeah, that's what I mean. I mean, you don't – for a guard, he's a great rebounder. I mean, 5 or 6 a game, you don't luck upon that for 4 years straight. Yeah, that's just good. You're just good at it. It's like Russell Westbrook. You're just a good rebounder. And Westbrook plays 15 minutes a game, but still. I think Ohio State's, like I said, one of the more unknown teams, and I think it's going to be interesting. It's going to be fun to watch because there's so much they can do with it. It's such a versatile lineup, and that's obviously what Chris Holmgren was going for. I made this comparison on Twitter, and I like it. The more I think about it, the more I like it. It's like an Arkansas or a Houston. If you remember watching them this year, there's not a lot of size, but it's just full of athletes. It's full of guys who can play any position. The only difference with Arkansas is I don't think this team has a JD Notae. But look, also, Tanner,
both of those teams had some great shooters.
Yeah, but so for this team, that's where the unknown comes in because Holden Suing are mid-30s for the three-pointer of their career, which is good. Not great, but good. Thornton and Gale can shoot it according to high school. So as long as that translates, you know, like you said, it's going to go one way or the other. It'll just be very interesting to see kind of which way it goes.
And that's what's kind of fun or agonizing if you're a fan, because right now
it's going to be inconsistent. I think
you have all the pieces now. And now people get to agonize over what they'll see. So just FYI, Justice Suing is a career 31% three-point shooter. But he was 31% at Cal, and he was 33% at Ohio State. But he's played way more games at Cal, so his overall is 31.3%. So I would not consider him a shooter. But you basically have two stencils of this team of what people are expecting. Because like if you say that, you know, yeah, Tanner Holden's only a 33% three-point shooter for his career, which I don't think it's good. That's not a good number. But Holtman has already said, yeah, this is going to be a big part of his game, and we expect him to – we're going to put him in spots where he's going to be able to succeed doing that a little bit more. And you expect that, like, Sensabaugh and Thornton and Gale and McNeil and Towns are all going to step in and just start shooting threes. People are like, okay, we've got some pieces here. But then you could also just pull up the raw numbers and say, you know, don't give me projections. Don't tell me how these guys are going to improve. Just look at the numbers, and it's not good. So that's kind of what's going on right now is you have like a stencil of like, here's how this team could be really, really good. And here's how this team could run into some serious problems if A, B, and C don't progress, basically.
The one thing I will say kind of, again, like I said, there is no JD Notae on this team. Arkansas shot the ball well at times. They were 12th in the SEC in total shooting. They shot the ball 30% from three. They were inconsistent too. So, and granted, that ended up being their downfall. That's why they lost to North Carolina. Or who did they lose to? North Carolina, right? In the tournament? Yeah.
No. They went far. They were an Elite Eight team again, right?
I think so, yeah. God, the tournament's so hard to remember what happens, especially when your team loses in the second round.
They lost to Duke, I think, didn't they?
No, that doesn't sound right.
Hold on, let me look.
I thought it was the Caleb Love went crazy game and they beat.
Oh, you're right. Arkansas was trash shooting three. I think it was Houston that I was looking at that was really
Houston,
good.
Houston is a good three-point shooting team, no doubt. Kyler Edwards was one of the best three-point shooters in the country, so that helps, obviously. There's no Kyler Edwards on this team, probably, unless Roddy Gale becomes. That's the only person I could see that could become that. Or, again, and
– yeah, dude, they lost to Duke. Arkansas lost to Duke. Yeah.
Who's the Caleb Love game? Whatever. That's irrelevant. Anyway, so they lost to Duke. I got the wrong ACC blue team, wrong color blue. But, you know, there is – you know, Eugene Brown, we keep calling him a 3-and-D. We might have to stop because he's shot the ball well from three for like 2 months his freshman year and then stopped. So, but hopefully he shoots the ball a little better this year and that helps because he's probably going to play 20, 25 minutes a game too. I don't know. The minutes are going to be extremely interesting and they're going to have to figure it out fast because, like I said, they play obviously in the CBS. It feels like they always get the raw end of the deal at the CBS Sports Classic. But again, this year they play North Carolina and not Kentucky or UCLA, which North Carolina is the best of those three. So it's always funny. It feels like they always play the best of the three. That's probably just me talking biasly, but it feels like it. And then they play whoever they play in the ACC Big Ten Challenge will probably be a good team. I predict like a Virginia, you know, something like that. They've already played them in that, but I don't know how they do. I don't know how they do the scheduling for that. So it's probably based upon standings, but I have no idea. They got to play the Big East in the Gavitt games, probably.
That'll be Butler.
Which we assume will be Butler, who is putting together a good team, a team they should beat. But Butler is putting together a good team. That model knows what he's doing. I'm not going to sit here, you know. That Duke can coach. Hot take. That model, good coach. And then they go to the Maui Invitational where they see They can see Arkansas, who might be the number one team in the country. They can see Creighton, who I think is a top five team in the country. They could play Cincinnati, who is putting together some guys. I mean, they're not going to be great, but they're going to be good. There's another top five team that's completely escaping me that's going to be there. Hold up, I just had the teams up. But like the Maui, that's one of the Arizona. A lot of them depends on Krishna Koloko and what he does. And Texas Tech's there too. And Louisville, who is probably going to get Imani Bates. So, I mean, this is a loaded, loaded field. And San Diego State, who's not great, but they play amazing defense. So they can always keep themselves in games. So that's, I mean, that could be, you could take three losses there. I mean, so it's going to be really interesting to see what they do early on. And I like playing tough schedules early on, you know, the Tom Izzo effect, where like Michigan State would be 6-6 after, through 12 games, but they're always ready for March because they play these incredible teams and they lose a lot in non-conference, but they play this crazy tough schedule. I like doing that. It gets you ready for these games. You're going to see these teams later down the road anyway, but it could make for some frustrated Buckeye fans if this team does start 3-5 or something like that, which I think it's hard
That's not going to happen.
But the Maui Invitational is your first, what, four, five, six games?
You don't play six games in the Maui Invitational. I think you play like
a match. No, I'm saying three, it's right? Your first. It's, you play like three games to start, and then you'll play like the Maui Invitational will be like your fourth, fifth, and sixth games of the season. It's Thanksgiving.
Oh, okay.
I'm saying that. So then right after that's the CBS Sports Classic. And right after that's the Big Ten ACC, and then it's the CBS Sports Classic. I mean, it's impossible without seeing a schedule in front of me, but their first 10 games, they could easily play five or six ranked teams. They could lose to all of them. I don't know. They probably will not be ranked to start the season. I don't think this is a ranked. I think this is a ranked team. I don't think this is a ranked team to start the season, but talent wise, I think they are. But I think there's so many questions. I don't think they will be. So it'll be interesting to see.
It'll be interesting to see what Ohio State's record is against top, like if you go like KenPom, like top 20, and then also like, where am I going with this? I feel like Ohio State's most frustrating losses are not games like Ohio State's going to be taking on number 6 Arizona in the Maui Invitational. It's Ohio State just lost on the road at Nebraska at the end of February. How the hell did this happen? It's like, I feel like they pull off a lot of really good wins against ranked teams, especially early in the season, every single year with Holtman. And those are not the games where I panic about or like, oh man, we're going to get our asses beat by so-and-so. It's like the frustrating ones are like losing to Iowa or Nebraska at home in February. So honestly, if it's a tough early season schedule and they play 6 ranked teams, I almost feel like you could pencil in Ohio State to win at least 2 or 3 of those, because that's just how they roll, especially early in season. It's not those aren't the games that trip me up. It's like at the end of the season, I'm like, all right, how is Ohio State going to like spill the pot of chili all over themselves down the stretch? Those are the losses that just aggravate Ohio State fans.
And it's so interesting with that, because I don't disagree with what you're saying. That Nebraska game was one of the most frustrating games I've watched as a fan ever. And, you know, same with the Maryland game. But then you turn around and you watch the same Nebraska team that still stinks. But the next game they play at Wisconsin with a Big Ten championship game or Big Ten championship on the line and no Bryce McGowan's, and they win that too. And it's like, what the hell is going on? So it's like, it's not necessarily – I think some of it's just bad luck. They just catch these teams at really bad times. And it's just – it's weird, man. I don't get it. You know, it's kind of like when you look at – you know, we don't have to get into this because we've talked this blue in the face. But it's kind of like the whole Chris Holtman can't get to the Sweet 16. But then you context it and it's like, well, there's a lot of context that goes into that, in my opinion, that kind of just been shit luck for Ohio State. If you look – like the Gonzaga team, they played with 4 NBA guys that was a – 4 seed for some ungodly reason, you know, like that kind of stuff. So it's very weird. Also, back to my Maui Invitational point, they could also play an easy schedule in the Maui Invitational. It just depends on how it goes. So, you know, the potential, they're not definitely going to play Arizona, Creighton, Arkansas. You know, they could, but they might not. So who knows?
Are we going to be boots on the ground in Maui? I'm not. You flying out to Maui?
I don't even know where Maui is. I'll be honest. It's like Hawaii, right?
Yeah, it's in Hawaii. We can edit that out. We can go ahead and edit that.
That's fine. Sure. I've admitted multiple times I'm not that bright.
Is it the capital of Hawaii?
I don't know. I feel like that's Honolulu, but I could be wrong.
So you knew that. You said, okay, yeah, that was correct.
I'm actually really good with capitals. I got a 50 out of 50 in fifth grade on that test and got a Wendy's prize because of it. And then I got bullied for getting the Wendy's. So if that's not elementary school, I don't know what is.
He's over here like, Maui. I thought that was just a character in Moana. He's like, I didn't know that was a – he's like, now all the points are starting to click together now.
Yeah. So we'll see. I'm glad I like when they play in these big invites. That's one of my favorite – Feast Week is one of my favorite weeks truly of sports ever because you got NFL on Thanksgiving and you have NBA starting to get kind of juicy a little bit. And you got college basketball like that week is just incredible basketball. So I like when they play in these tournaments, but you play tough teams. Creighton's going to be very, very good.
People who think I'm crazy for like tripping out about college basketball in November, like, bro, they're like, imagine watching college basketball before February. I'm like, imagine not watching any of these games this week. Imagine not watching like Kentucky versus UCLA, Ohio State versus North Carolina. Like, For example, imagine not watching this shit just because it's in November and you're like, oh, wait till February or March when it actually matters. I'm like, are you kidding me?
Well, and that's my favorite thing in the world. I'll wait till February so you can watch what? Clemson play Virginia Tech? Come on. Like,
and you're telling me this shit because you're probably watching like fucking Jacksonville Jaguars play like the Oakland Raiders on Thursday night football. Shut the front door, man. Get out of here.
Yeah, I had people yelling at me this year because I was watching college basketball on Thanksgiving and not the NFL. And the NFL, like this year, the NFL first game is the Commanders against the Lions. Nobody's who cares. I'm gonna watch basketball.
Por qué no los dos? You know, I'll watch some. You got football going on Thanksgiving. I'll watch that. But if there's hoops on too, man, like it's just whatever.
Anyway. And you get like 10 o'clock hoops games because it's like early round. Oh, it's the best.
Bill Walton on shrooms calling like UCLA versus Oregon. Yeah. Ooh. We did want to talk about NIL pay for play, specifically the guy at Miami, Isaiah Wong.
Just Miami in general, because Nigel Pack is pretty interesting too.
I think this has happened. This may have happened right around when we put out the last episode. Basically, you know, Nigel Pack, he went to Miami. We already talked about that. But like 5 minutes after he announced he's going to Miami, that attorney down in Miami announced like Nigel Pack, we signed him to an NIL deal, $400,000 over 2 years, plus a car. And then a few days later. Which is a red flag all in itself, because to announce an NIL deal like that right at the same time, yeah, that's like sketchy. But then right after that, one of Miami's star players, Isaiah Wong, basically made a statement through his agent saying, if there's not more NIL money coming to me through Miami, then I'm going to transfer elsewhere. So basically pay me more money or I'm leaving. And then like a day or two later, he came out and said, I never made that statement. That was my agent. Saying that independently, I never told him to say that, which I think that's a bunch of hogwash. I don't believe that at all. But then he's like, I love it at Miami. I'm staying at Miami. But yeah, he basically said, pay me more money or I'm going to transfer. Like, it's like an open market, which that's not how what NIL was meant to do.
No, we're approaching this kind of weird because, and I think you'd agree with this, I'm cool with NIL, both payers. With players making money off their own name, image, and likeness, that's common sense. The fact like Johnny Manziel would be suspended for signing an autograph, getting paid for it, that's his name. That's crazy to me. But now we're kind of approaching this weird kind of impasse to where it is not NIL anymore. It's just pay for play. Very clear and simple. Which in the NIL rules, it does explicitly say you cannot use money and NIL stuff for recruiting purposes. They use bigger words, but that's what it says. For recruiting purposes, you cannot use NIL stuff. Now, and that's clearly being done. I mean, it's just like, you'd have to be kind of an idiot to not see that. Or you just don't want to see it. That's probably the main thing. But now we're also getting into this weird spot of where people that agree with NIL, you can't really even like bring up anything bad about it because they're like, oh, you don't appreciate the player's rights. It's like, well, that's not what I said. What I'm saying is this is pay for play, and that's what NIL is not supposed to be. It's clearly what it is right now. And we're getting into kind of – the NCAA completely butchered this, and of course they do. Mark Emmert, I'm going to throw a party during his retirement party of my own, because the fact they butchered this so bad is incredible. They knew NIL was coming. You knew this was coming for a year or two, and they did nothing to get in front of it. They did nothing to kind of try to emphasize – to put NIL and pay-for-play in two different lanes, and now they're behind the ball and they're trying to get in front of it. They just released something today about – I didn't get a chance to read it. I was at work, but about new NIL rules and stuff like that. So they're getting into a – we're in a weird kind of space with NIL right now because, like you said, it's clearly pay-for-play. I mean, that Isaiah Wong or Nigel Pack stuff was announced simultaneously. And, like, if I'm Nigel Pack, I'm not even sure I want that announced like it was. You know what I mean? Because people are – I guess he's just – he doesn't care what people think, but – I don't think it's that great of a look. I don't know.
It's like NIL was meant to be.
It's going to be interesting to see if they can actually punish them too for like anything.
I mean,
we just watched Kansas win a national championship and Bill Self arguably should be in jail. So like, you know, it's, you know,
one of the biggest bag men in the business.
I mean,
NIL was supposed to be, like you said, like Zed Key can go to like a local, like Buckeye Corner, the Ohio State Sporting Goods store, this like fan gear store that's on campus or near campus here, and like sign autographs and like make money because, you know, he makes money off the autographs. The people show up to the store and are probably going to buy merch that they want him to sign. So basically the business is benefiting because he's there and he's making money off his name, or like doing speaking appearances, doing commercials and stuff. Like opportunities present themselves to you because you are an athlete. But it's turned into like, it's such a twisted thing now, because you literally have like Isaiah Wong saying, I need more money from the Miami boosters / whoever does NIL at Miami, which it's like NIL is an exchange of money for the athlete, like doing something, like not necessarily work, but like even signing an autograph, doing a commercial, like, it's not just like handing you cash.
Sponsorships and whatnot, yes.
Right. It's not just handing you cash. It's like you're doing some type of action that you are now getting paid for because of your status as an athlete. It's not just like Miami. And Miami, the school can't pay him. It has to be like the boosters, the small businesses and the nonprofits in Miami that are like, Isaiah, we want you to be in this commercial. And that's so weird for a player to be like, I need more money or I'm gone, because that's not – how it was intended to be. And it's just like an awkward demand, because that's not really how it was designed to be, if that makes sense. Like I said, like autographs, doing commercials, like opportunities that businesses would have liked college athletes to be able to take advantage of before and couldn't do it. Now they can do it. Now car dealerships can reach out and have players in their commercials and so on and so forth. So it's weird for a player to be like, I need more NIL money or else I'm leaving.
Yeah, and I think the best way to word it is like NIL is paid because of play, kind of like how you're playing with your autographs, your sponsorships. The bigger the name, the more, you know, sell jerseys, stuff like that. This is just pay for play. You know, it's just pay. We want you to play, so come on. And so it's getting kind of, like I said, I don't have the answer for it, because I think most people saw this coming. I mean, this was kind of the natural progression it was going to take, but the NCAA just did nothing to get to put those safeguards in place. Like I said, I don't know what the punishment would even be. Are you going to suspend the player? Are you going to suspend the boost? I don't know what you're going to do. Can you prove any of it? Probably not. I'm sure not, because they announced it really confidently. So they have to assume they're not going to get in trouble. So it's getting kind of a weird, you know. And look, and again, I'll say this again because I want to be on the record with it. I agree with NIL. I think there's way more pros than cons, and I think that most teams are using it how it should be used, and it's not as big of a problem as I think it kind of seems to be right now, but it's going to keep blowing up. If like nothing happens in Miami, people will just go, oh, well, okay, that's what we can do. Okay, cool. You know, let's do that.
Yeah. Some people will just say like, cool, pay for play. Honestly, I don't care. Who cares? Make it a professional league, essentially. Let them just do pay for play. Let businesses and teams compete, and let recruits go to whatever place is going to pay them the most money. Let it be literally pay for play. Who cares? It should be that way. Agreed. And I mean, I don't like how what makes college sports and specifically basketball so great. One of the things is how smaller schools that don't have the financial firepower as some other schools have just as much of a chance, for the most part, to make a run in March Madness to win your conference tournament as anybody else. And I think that if it becomes complete pay for play, I feel like the same few schools are going to monopolize all of the best recruits and transfers, because it's not like that right now. Especially in the last several years, you've seen top players go to a lot of different schools, in all the different major conferences. So I don't think that recruits aren't being monopolized to only the best programs, but I think that if it became pay for play, I think it would start to look more like college football, where you have the same three or four teams dominating because they financially have the people in their community that can just hog all of the best players if it was just straight pay for play. I could be totally wrong about that, but that's my opinion. I love that a team like Oral Roberts, as much as it hurts to talk about, or a team like St. Peter's has a great opportunity to compete in their conference for a conference title and then compete in the NCAA tournament and have a great chance to advance. And I think if it becomes pay for play, I think that becomes a lot harder. I think the top three or four teams would really, really, really dominate.
Yeah, and I think that's where the distinction between NIL and pay for play should come up, because I agree with you on pay for play. NIL, I actually hoped it might help smaller schools do a little better, because these guys, like, let's say you have a Bruce Thornton would be a good example, or a lot of guys in this Ohio State recruiting class, like not a top 10 guy, but still a very good player, a four-star recruit. You know, instead of going to a Kentucky or a Duke where they might not play immediately, they want to go, well, I can make money off my name. I need to make that known more. Let me go to, you know, a smaller school, not necessarily mid-major, but a smaller Power Five. Get my name and brand out there, you know, basically make a brand is basically what you're trying to do with NIL. So I was hoping that might actually help it. Pay for play won't, because it's just all the top teams have the most money. They're going to pay the most. It's just math. But yeah, I don't know. And again, like you said, I have no problem with them. I have no problem with pay for play. I don't care. You know, I don't think it's incredible that people still call NCAA a amateur league or whatever, when it's a $1 billion industry. Like, it's not. There's a lot of money that's being funneled into it, and the players deserve a piece of that pie, in my opinion. It's just, don't call it NIL. It's not that. It's pay for play. So that's where I'm at with that.
It just, I don't know. It just seems so hollow to me. It just seems so hollow. Like, the recruitment process, if you had pay for play, just seems so hollow.
I do think we'd be remiss if we didn't point out pay for play has been happening for 30 years. It's just been under the table. Now it's just out in the open, you know.
Yeah, it's just like, it's like the whole recruiting process. And what's fun about, I'm trying to think of a fun example. Like, for example, last year when Pittsburgh was, it looked like Pittsburgh, this is actually a great example. When Pittsburgh, it looked like had a commitment from Efton Reed, who was a five-star center in that class last year. And Pittsburgh sucked and still sucks. Pittsburgh looked like they almost had a recruit who could potentially change the direction of your program just like that. And then we don't have it in writing yet, but LSU dropped the bag in the last few seconds and got him to go to LSU. Obviously, Will Wade burnt up in a flaming heap because of all that stuff. But, you know, if that becomes legitimate and it's just like, yeah, like LSU can just straight outbid Pittsburgh, to me, that just takes some of like, what makes college recruiting so fun and interesting is that a coach can develop a relationship with a recruit that maybe is stronger than a brand name like a Duke or a Kentucky. Well, even if like Jeff Capel has a really good relationship with a recruit and he's like, I've got the inside track to get this kid. If like a Kentucky swoops in and a booster at Kentucky's like, we'll pay you $500,000 to come here. How is a kid supposed to say no to that, regardless of how good of a relationship he has with another coach?
I mean, you're not wrong. Like I said, I think we would be a little remiss to not point out that that's been happening. It's just been illegal and under the table. But like, that's why guys like Will Wade have gotten into trouble, and Bill Self. But you know, we'll see kind of where it goes. I don't know that. I don't know that it's going to be something everybody loves. I think it's just going to be kind of one of those things, but it's here to stay. I think that's definitely the case. It's definitely where college sports is heading. So, you know, it is what it is at this point.
Last thing, if you are a Marvel person, you have not seen Doctor Strange and the Multiverse of Madness, go ahead and skip the final 10 minutes of this episode. We don't want to ruin it for you. But we're going to talk about that for a minute, because I know you saw it on opening night. I saw it the second night. I thought it was good. I didn't think it was fantastic. I thought some of like the effects and the images and like the colors and the crazy like trippy stuff was super cool. I thought it made it kind of unique from some of the other Marvel movies, like the imagery they used. But I feel like with the multiverse, there's so many holes in the logic that you can poke at.
Yeah, and that was kind of inevitable when they start talking about doing a multiverse. I think this movie is where you're going to lose a lot of like – it'll be interesting to see how their box office starts to do, because this is where you kind of start to lose like casual just moviegoers. It's like, oh, Marvel movie's on. Like, let me watch that. Like, this is not that. This is like, what the hell is going on? So I agree with you. I gave it a 7 out of 10. It's not bad. It's not great. I did not like Eternals. Like, it's not that bad to me. But like, it's not No Way Home or anything, which is something I really, really enjoyed. So, yeah, it was all right. I like Benedict Cumberbatch, and Elizabeth Olsen might need an Oscar for this, but that's it.
Were you shocked that they completely turned Wanda / Scarlet Witch? They really turned her into just a straight like villain in this movie. I know, like,
I was surprised with how
most Marvel movies go. Like, the villains usually have good intentions, but they really just made her like a straight villain, the main antagonist.
Yeah, I mean, the line she says to John Krasinski was like, "Good, they'll have somebody to raise them." I was like, "God," and then obliterates him. Yeah, and then like holds true to that promise. I wasn't surprised that they did it. I assumed she was going to be the villain in this. Like, kind of a House of M, for people to read comics, the House of M storyline. I didn't think they would do it that fast. Like, she's the villain the entire time, you know?
I didn't know that she was going to be the villain.
I thought she was going to flip. Like, and the family thing makes sense. I just thought she was going to flip for maybe, and they always, Marvel does this thing, they do it well, and it's not, I'm not saying this as a knock on it, but they always put that little, like, kind of out in there if they need it. For example, like, in this one, it was the Darkhold. Oh, she's being controlled by the Darkhold the entire time. You know, so at some point, she's going to need to face up for some of the stuff she's doing. But, I mean, she's just murdering people. But, you know, so.
How many bodies does she leave behind in this movie? Like, at least like 40 or 50, right?
She obliterates. Where'd they go? What's that called again? Why do I want to say Kamertage? Is that right?
Yeah. Their castle. Yeah, so that's what I'm saying. She probably killed at least 20 or 30 people just there by itself.
She kills all four members of the Illuminati quick, which was – and that's a – I had a problem with the marketing of this movie, because I knew three of Xavier was in the trailer. Captain Carter was briefly in the trailer. And Captain Marvel was in the trailer. So, and I knew it wasn't Brie Larson, so I assumed it was Maria Rambeau. So I was like, you know, you're telling us all these. Now, the John Krasinski thing is Reed Richards was dope. That was a great reveal. I was very surprised by that, because that's been so highly fan casted. It felt like it was impossible for them to actually do it, you know? So that was cool. But then they just immediately killed him. But, you know, I'm sure they'll keep it that way. But I mean, I'm sure he'll still be Reed Richards in whatever they do moving forward. But it was good. It was there were some things I wish I didn't know going in. Like I said, like the Charles Stewart was in it, Professor Xavier. I just combined both. I combined his name in the movie and his name in real life. But you know, I like Baron Mordo. I wish we get more of him, because Chiwetel Ejiofor, I think I said that right, is awesome. He's an amazing actor, and it feels like we're not getting enough. And Baron Mordo is a really, really cool villain. And they keep kind of not nerfing him, but in the first movie, he's good for 99% of it. And then this movie, they don't really, I don't know if he's good or bad. It's weird. So I need more Baron Mordo, but Yeah, I don't know. It's definitely Sam Raimi. That was definitely directed. You don't need to tell me who the director was. I probably could have guessed.
Tarantino
movie.
I had very little information going in.
That's good. You're lucky.
I didn't know that they were going to flip. I did not know they were going to flip Wanda into the main antagonist. I had no idea. Maybe I'm ignorant. Maybe your like Twitter timeline is more curated to like show you more Marvel stuff than mine. Like I have not watched the What If series. I've watched everything else. Did not watch the What If series. So like I did not know they were going to have all the variants of those characters as like, you know, the big four up there and that Illuminati. I knew very little going into the movie about the meat and potatoes of it. So I don't know, all that stuff that sounds like it might have been spoiled for you. It was not spoiled for me, luckily. I liked at the end. At first I thought it was corny, and then as I did it, I was like, actually this is kind of cool. The whole possessing the dead body thing and the rules against that, how you had like the souls and like the demons attacking him, and I was like, oh, this is so corny. But then like the logic kind of connected in a weird movie way. And then he throws all these demons together and makes a cape out of them. And like the whole time he's talking, also he's got like this moldy, decaying face where I just couldn't stop laughing. Like he was like when he was talking to America Chavez, and his like face is like falling apart, and like the skin flap is pulled up over his teeth, and it looks like he's grinning the whole time. I just couldn't stop laughing. And I was like, okay, actually, this is actually kind of cool. At first, I was corny. Actually, kind of cool how this played out.
Yeah, I did like that part, and especially I just like when they go against kind of rules, because you know at some point that's going to come back to bite them. If it wasn't this movie, it's going to be something else. Like we'll see Strange a lot more in the future. I didn't like the actual end of it where she just like sees the kids and she's like, oh, that is pretty bad. Like you've now murdered like 100 of people. This just clicked in your brain that your kids might be scared of you? Like
she what? Throws yeah.
Like she you're not throws, their mom. You're confusing them.
She throws real Wanda up against the wall like she's a pillow and just tosses her.
It beats the hell out of their actual mother and goes, no, I'm your mommy. What other every 7-year-old will be like, what is going on?
They're like, don't hurt me. And she's like, what do you mean don't hurt you? Why would I ever hurt you? And they look at their mother with like a broken neck laying on the ground.
And you have like half your face is burnt off. Like it was like the screenwriters, and I know the screenwriter is Michael Waldron, who I actually really like. But it's like they got like 95% of the way through and like, wait, how do we end this movie? It's like, all right, cool. And also I kind of wish America Chavez was introduced in like a TV show or something just before this, because like she was cool. She's a good actress. I just didn't care. You know, there was so much else going on. I just didn't really care about her. So I need to have a little more. And she's going to be in a lot of stuff. But again, it was just like, this is a tough movie to introduce. Like No Way Home didn't really introduce anybody. And I think that was a very good that played to the benefit of the movie, because it could just get right to it and get rolling. I will say this movie wasted no time. I mean, it's a tight 2 hours. They are going from the jump. So that's cool. But
I thought the Spider-Man joke at the beginning was hilarious. When they're like, yeah, there was an incident with Spider-Man. She's like, Spider-Man? They're like, yeah, he's a spider. He's a man. He shoots web. She's like, out his butt? And they're like, no, well, I don't know. And then this movie, because that carries over from No Way Home. Like, nobody knows.
Yeah.
Knows about Spider-Man. Spider-Man is erased. Yeah. I'm like, oh, well, that's clever.
Well, Peter Parker, they'd obviously know Spider-Man because they're talking about him. But yeah, they don't know that, like, I think the whole thing, at least in the comics, when that happens is like they know who Spider-Man is, but all their interactions with him are gone. So that's why they're like, well, I don't know how he shoots webs. You know what I mean? Because they don't remember their interaction with him. So that was a cool, like, all right, here's the rules of this, at least. I do think that will probably get confusing later on too. But and when it happens in the comics, they just have a quick, again, their quick out of like, when he sees people that he used to know, their memories flood back to him. You know, that's very comic booky. Of just like, all right, let's ignore that. Let's like, we got to get going. So let's ignore what we just did, and let's who cares? We'll get going. So we'll see how that goes. But hey, overall, like I'll watch it. I don't know if I'll go to the theaters again to see it. I'm not a scary movie fan. Now this isn't a scary movie, but like there are a couple jump scares where I'm like, I don't know if I like that. So that's also, I've seen one scary movie in my life and I'll never see another. So that was probably, that probably didn't help its benefit to me. But it's also interesting, and I was talking to this with a friend afterwards. They've done the multiverse now with basically three things in a row, with Loki, then Spider-Man, and now Doctor Strange. They're not going to touch it for a while because their next three movies are Thor, Wakanda Forever. Neither of those will touch it. And then the movie after that is well, now it's Ant-Man, so that's when they'll touch it again. But it was Captain Marvel, which probably wouldn't touch it, but now it's Ant-Man, so that will probably touch it again.
Do they push Captain Marvel back, or do they stop it altogether?
They switched. Captain Marvel was supposed to come out in February of next year and Ant-Man in May, and they just switched them. Okay. So Ant-Man's in February and Captain Marvel's in May. I don't know why. Probably they're running really thin on like people that can actually – when they make these movies, they're so CGI heavy. There's only so many people in the industry that can actually do that. So they're like kind of running these people kind of rampant. So I think it was probably a CGI effect visual thing. But yeah, we'll see. You know, it's kind of interesting because like I said, we've talked about the multiverse so much for the past 8 months, and now they're just going to stop.
How do they transition and just abruptly stop mentioning it?
Yes. You know, like Thor is not going to be about that at all. We know what that's about, which I'm super excited to see Christian Bale as Gore the God Butcher, but that's for another day. But and even the shows coming out are Miss Marvel, which won't touch it, and She-Hulk, which won't touch it. So,
man, we got like 10-15 minutes of that in there. Last thing, pretty much it. Shout outs. I'm gonna give a shout out to Reed Detmers.
Yes. I think it was his
13th career start last night, which I guess when this comes out, two nights ago. No hitter, only two strikeouts, which is crazy. Two strikeouts in a no hitter, so 25 outs in contact. But I think he did it in just over 100 pitches in his 13th career start. No hitter, Reed Detmers. Super, super, super cool to watch. I think that combined no hitters are super lame, and so to me, this is the first no hitter of the year, which is pretty sick.
Yes, I agree. I was going to shout out the Angels just because I want to see more of who I believe is the best player to ever play the game in the playoffs in Mike Trout. But I'm actually going to shout out something different because I'm on Twitter right now. And I just saw Benedict Cumberbatch passed on Thor 2's villain role of Malekith. I guess he got that role and he passed because he was holding out for something a bit more juicy. And he got strange. So believe in yourself, kids. You might get it. You might think you're Malekith, but you could be a Doctor Strange. So believe in yourself.
That will do it for us today. If you're finding us on the website, make sure to also subscribe on Spotify, Apple Music, wherever you get your music and podcasts. We are under the Land Grant Holy Land feed.
And if you want to catch us on Twitter, we are at Bucketheads, LGHL. We were at 200 followers, but then someone unfollowed us. So now we're at 199. So if we could get one more follower, that'd be great. And the main account is Land Grant 33. That's where you'll catch every... Obviously, with football season coming up, you know, we do some great stuff with Buck Off Podcast and I hang out in the Holy Land and obviously all the articles you write. So make sure you're checking out everything Land Grant has to offer. I'm Justin_Golba on Twitter. Connor, where are you?
You can follow me at Lamons_Connor on Twitter. Thanks for listening, everybody. Thank you for bearing with us with the movie stuff. If you don't like Marvel movies, that's too damn bad. It's our podcast and we make the rules. Have a great weekend, everybody. Go Bucks.